I ask Brother Matthew to step forward and deliver us a word of exhortation based on Psalm 46.
Good morning, brethren and sisters. Just want to say first that I thought Brother Robert very suitably introduced our remarks this morning when he picked hymn 10. He asked me before starting this morning whether I had any hymns to think of relevant to this exhortation, and I couldn't think of any off the top of my head, but I was completely unaware that that hymn was there, which is the substance of Psalm 46, which is our psalm for this morning. Well, in Psalm 46, we have the opening remarks, God is our refuge and strength. Often in the Psalms, we are presented with the ponderable of whether the Psalm in question applies to Christ, or if it applies to David, or if it's just an expression of sentiments which we need to grasp upon and follow. Whilst, of course, they are an expression of sentiments, they are a model for the saints, what we believe is that this psalm being presented to us is a psalm which depicts the glorified saints and is similar to the Song of Moses and the Song of the Lamb, which is sung by the redeemed. This is a song which we believe can be sung by the glorified saints, and it projects us into the future. We could look at some of the other psalms which say Yahweh is my shepherd, I shall not want, and many others. Often the psalms concentrate on an individual level, but this psalm is talking from the perspective of a group of people, and the question is, who are the people speaking? God is whose refuge and strength? I believe, yes, it is Israel. That is perhaps what we would naturally think, and I don't believe that's an incorrect interpretation. It refers to the Elohim of Jacob in Psalm 46, which is something which would make us specifically think of the Jews. But I do believe that we would also miss an important lesson if we were to fail to recognize the application to the saints. Now, the linchpin for my interpretation is actually secreted in the title, and Brother Philip, in his remarks yesterday, took the subscription to my psalm and applied it to his, so I won't wish to be dogmatic about this, but I'll present you the ideas anyhow, and you can take the lessons from it that you wish. The subtitle is as follows. Well, the subtitle, as I thought prior to giving this talk and prior to Brother Philip's address yesterday, I understood to be that whole of the introduction to the chief musician for the sons of Korah, a song upon Alamoth, and I had completely forgotten that there was a dispute over whether part or all of that subscription was relevant to the previous psalm. Well, put this out as a suggestion for you anyway, and you can take it or leave it. As I said, I'm going to suggest that maybe a song upon Alamoth is applicable to Psalm 46 and that only. Alamoth, as Brother Philip said, is the word for virgin. And as he also said, it's for soprano voices. So the psalm, either Psalm 45 or Psalm 45, to whichever it refers, is a psalm to be sang by soprano voices, females. And what is the significance of that? I'm sure if we were to just ponder it for a moment, the the answer would jump out at us. And if in our minds we go to Revelation 14, we remember that vision there which John saw of the Lamb upon Mount Zion. And there were 144,000. And what were the 144,000? They were virgins. They were virgins. And of course, there was nothing literal about that. You know, there wasn't anything literal about a lamb and 144 virgins standing upon Mount Zion. What was being conveyed was that important lesson that the character of saints are indicated and depicted by that analogy of virgins, unpolluted and spoilt by the world, pure and chaste. And further to that, I think if we look at the tenor of the psalm, I'm sure singing that hymn, we would have realized, and I don't particularly need to stand here and say it, that this is unquestionably a psalm of the future. Who the people are singing this psalm, who are prefigured by that hour of verse 1, is perhaps a little bit uncertain, but the historical or futuristic context of the psalm is not one thing that we are in doubt about. It's post-resurrectional. Some of the themes of the psalm are firstly God being a refuge in a high place. We see that in verse 1, 7 and 11. We get secondly a repeat of the theme of judgment, which was considered yesterday at length. Verse 1 to 3, 6 and 7 to 9. Third, we get the position of Judah as exempt from the troubles which are to ensue. So that this is not only post-resurrectional, it's post the time of Judah's troubles. And if you look at verse 4 to 5, talking about Judah, it says, "She shall not be moved, and Elohim is in the midst of her." So we're looking at a time when Christ is enthroned in Zion, at a time when Jacob's troubles are over, when the time of their pain and calamity and their persecution in all nations is over. And the fourth theme we've got is in verse 10, and that's God's glory, something which is perhaps most prevalent throughout the Psalms at large. God's glory is exaltation throughout the earth. Now we're here to exhort ourselves, to stir us up by way of remembrance, and perhaps it's therefore our duty to concentrate on some of the exhortational aspects. And I know the brothers who've given the addresses thus far have already very much conditioned our minds for that sort of thing anyway, and I'm sure any of the speakers could have stood here and given their remarks, and it would have been very much in context for a memorial exhortation. And perhaps all I'll be saying here is just re-emphasizing what has already been presented to us. What I think we can do perhaps this morning as we think about Psalm 46 is try to convey our minds to the future and imagine ourselves standing among that glorified throng. And the question for us is, will we be there? Or we could put it a different way, where will we stand in that day? Will we be that bride which Brother Philip was talking about yesterday? All glorious within, presented to the King in raiment of needlework. And we can't, of course, just give a single answer to it. I mean, of course, yes, it will be yes or no. It's up to us to determine. And many things will make up the answer to that question. The answer comes in how we live our lives now. One of the things which will be a determining feature, I believe, is what we read in verse 1. God is our refuge and strength. I believe that will be a determining feature of whether we will stand amongst that elected and accepted in that day. It's a good means of testing ourselves to see whether we will stand among that group of people. And one way of testing whether we do trust on God is to see if we rely on other things. Brother Steve said in his address on Friday that if we trust in God, if our heart pants after God and the things of the truth, then it won't be panting after other things. And what I'd like to do is just to think of some of the things which we are in danger of trusting in to our peril. Some of the things which we really need to avoid as far as trust is concerned, so that we are stripped of any other distraction and so we can concentrate on trusting in God. One of the things which we can't trust in is man. Is man. Or men. Psalm 118, verse 8. It is better to trust in Yahweh than to put confidence in man. It is better to trust in Yahweh than to put confidence in princes. Psalm 146, verse 3 to 4. Put not your trust in princes, nor in the Son of Man, in whom there is no help. His breath goeth forth, he returneth to his earth. In that very day his thoughts perish. Happy is he that hath the God of Jacob for his help, whose hope is in Yahweh, his Elohim. It's not that men or our acquaintances can't be of any help to us, but as we know, even Christ's disciples, as we were discussing yesterday, in his dire moment of need, actually left him, and he was left alone, left completely alone. And in many ways, what we need to do is make sure that we're not placing undue trust in the sons of men. Perhaps that's not something which many of us will be in danger of doing, but it's worth mentioning anyhow. Another thing which we can do in danger is rely on the things, the wisdom of this world and the thinking of this world. We won't turn to it now, but you could turn to 1 Corinthians 1 verse 27 and 2 verse 13. There Paul brings out the fact that the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God, and that God hath made foolishness the wisdom of this world. We've got the example of Demas, who having loved the things of this world forsook Paul. 1 to that, just moving our thoughts on a bit further than that, the things of this world can in a general sense draw our attentions away. We're not talking necessarily about influences and affections and things like that. We're talking in the context of trust. And riches and possessions can become a sort of a refuge for us if we don't place them in their appropriate position. Let's turn to Luke chapter 12. And in many ways, we can say that we're all rich when we compare ourselves to the men in Christ's time. Well, men throughout many centuries and generations bygone, none of us lack anything really that's needful. If we look in Luke 12, verse 15, he said, "Take heed, beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of things which he possesseth." And he spake a parable unto them, saying, "The ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. He thought within himself, saying, What shall I do, because I have no room where to bestow my fruits? And he said, This will I do, I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said unto him, fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then whose shall those things be which thou hast provided? It is a great danger of the things of this world. We're not talking about massive accumulation of wealth, but the things of this world, our possessions, can become a snare to us if they become the source of our trust and reliance, if we are proverbially building those bigger barns. Mark 4 verse 19 is the parable which Christ gave concerning the sowing of the seed, and he said that the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word. That was in his exposition of the meaning of the thorn, the thorny ground. Along the same lines, but perhaps subtly different, we could turn to Amos chapter 6. In the prophecy of Amos was addressing a class of people similar to our own. Due to the political situation at the moment, in the time when Amos was addressing the people of Israel, there was a certain amount of peace. Some of the greater powers were absorbed with other things, and what had happened was that Israel were able to enjoy the benefits of the access to the sea coast. They were enjoying ease and prosperity. And here was what Amos said to them: woe to them that are at ease in Zion and trust in the mountains of Samaria, which are named chief of the nations to whom the house of Israel come. And interestingly, he said in verse 2, go to Calneh, go see Hamath, have a look at Gath. Are they any worse than you? Are you better than these kingdoms? Are their border greater than your border? Are they any different to you? And it's a question which perhaps we need to ask ourselves. Have a look around you and see the people in this life. Are we any different to them? And we'd like to hope so. It's a question we need to answer ourselves individually. And look what happened in verse 11. For behold, Yahweh commandeth, and he will smite the great house with breaches and the little house with clefts. Just like a leprous house under the law, a house under the law which had dry rot, was to be abolished. Utterly and totally abolished. No redeeming the situation. Destruction was the only thing decreed for it. And that's eventually what happened to Israel. Verse 13, ye which rejoice in a thing of naught, which say, have we not taken to us horns by our own strength? But behold, I will raise up against you a nation, O house of Israel, saith Yahweh, Elohim of armies, and they shall afflict you from the entering in of Hamath unto the river of the wilderness. And we know what the end was of the kingdom of Israel when, in that very ignominious and very debasing, cruel way, they were taken with with hooks in their jaws out from the land of Israel by the king of Assyria. Finally, what we must not trust in is ourselves. And this is what we are most in danger of doing, I believe. The heart is desperately wicked and deceitful above all things. The prophet Jeremiah told us that because absolutely the heart is deceitful. It's dangerous because we can think everything's okay when it's not. There is a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof is death. And it is by the scrutiny of the word that we can determine whether our lives are right before God, whether we really are trusting in God or trusting in ourselves. Let's have a look at Proverbs chapter 3. Verse 5, trust in Yahweh with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. Lean not unto thine own understanding. In many ways we can perhaps self-elevate our own understanding. We can think, well, we're in the truth, and therefore we know what's best. In reality, even in the most mundane issues of our lives, we're in danger of deviating and doing our own thing and trusting to our own understanding. We really must trust in Yahweh and examine ourselves to see whether we are doing our own thing or doing what God would have us do. Just finally, to something to think about. Psalm 51 and verse 5. Concerning Christ, it was said, behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. He said in verse 7, purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me to hear joy and gladness, that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice. Verse 10, create in me a clean heart, O Elohim, and renew a right spirit within me. Just wanted to turn to that psalm to help us remember how evil the flesh is by nature, and how even doing things in the truth can sometimes be tainted with the ugliness of sin, and how it's very important that our hearts are trusting in God, and that whatever our activities are, whatever our disposition is, however we look on the surface, we need to make sure in our hearts we're trusting in God. And it's so important, and not only important, it's so advantageous to us to trust solely in God. I've got a large list of references in the Psalms which would be nice to turn to, but I'll just pick a few out. We'll turn first to Psalm 56 verse 1. Be merciful unto me, O Elohim, for man would swallow me up. Be fighting daily, oppresseth me. There was the psalmist, cognizant of his inability to grapple with the daily oppression of men. And we think of Christ there with the scribes and Pharisees, really realizing that he was dealing on purely physical levels with a far greater power than he was able to deal with. Of course, he could have called down 10 legions of angels, but the Holy Spirit wasn't given him for that purpose. Moving on to 57 verse 1. Be merciful unto me, O God, be merciful unto me, for my soul trusteth in thee. Yea, in the shadow of thy wings will I make my refuge until these calamities be overpast. 62 verse 1. Truly my soul waiteth upon Elohim, from him cometh my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved. Verse 6 to 10 are also worth looking at of that chapter. We'll just turn lastly to Psalm 94, verse 17. Unless Yahweh had been my help, my soul had dwelt in silence. In Matthew 6, Christ said that we need take no thought for the morrow, what things pertain to the morrow. And the frame of mind he advocated was a complete abandonment of care about the things of this life. And he wasn't advocating that we don't do the necessary things of this life, but he said the things of the morrow will take care for themselves. What we need to do is concentrate on trusting in God and the things of the truth. I would just like to turn to Psalm 55 and verse 22, where we read, "Cast thy burden upon Yahweh, and he will sustain thee. He shall never suffer the righteous to be moved." Now, we mustn't be surprised if trusting in God leaves us feeling or seeming worse off in some respects. We haven't been told that we would have ease and plenty and that everything would go well for us. We've been told that it's a narrow way, few there be that find it, beset with obstacles of various kinds. But what we have been told also is that he that saveth his life shall lose it. He that loseth his life for my sake shall find it. So if we carve out for ourselves a very pleasant existence in the present, perhaps what we're doing is saving our lives. But if we're prepared to do without for the sake of the truth, then what we're doing is perhaps losing our life for Christ's sake. And keeping that thought in mind about he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it, we'll then have a look at back at Psalm 46, at that second part of verse 1. A very present help in trouble. Literally, what the Hebrew says is to be found exceedingly, or to be found greatly. So what it means is God is our refuge and strength, to be found exceedingly in trouble. "Seek and ye shall find," Christ said. It is really as simple as that. But it must be a genuine hungering and thirsting after righteousness. It's not just a casual, inert, supine sort of finding or searching. It's got to be genuine and eager. A hungering and thirsting after righteousness. In Jeremiah 29 verse 13 we read, "Seek me, ye shall find me, if ye seek for me with your whole heart." And we must, to do that, cut off all that which does offend. Ezekiel 14 verse 4 talks to us about the idols in the heart of the children of Israel. If those idols there are occupying our affections, then God is displaced. And we really cannot afford to serve two masters. Either we would love the one and hate the other. I can't remember how the rest of the verse finishes. But moving on, what is the trouble to which is being this verse is referring? Let us be careful to apply this to any trouble we might receive, but I would like to suggest that this is actually referring to a specific time of trouble. Specific time of trouble. That word is the same word as we find in Daniel 12 verse 1. It is, I believe, the time of trouble to which this verse is referring. In that time of trouble, we will be closeted away in the chambers of Isaiah 26. Closeted away while the world is engulfed in calamity. The opportunity is there for us to seek that refuge from it. And it will be obvious then that reliance on the flesh will be like leaning on the broken reed of Egypt. Trusting in the things of this life will at last, like that reed of Egypt which the prophets refer to, leaning upon it would pierce the person leaning upon it. It was a broken reed, and you can imagine that the sharpness of a broken reed and leaning upon it as Israel did was going to damage them in the long run. But reliance on Yahweh is the only thing which will reap the everlasting reward. He will be found exceedingly. Verse 2, "Therefore will not we fear though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea." The word though is assumed and is not there in the Hebrew. It is literally, therefore will we not fear in the removing of the earth and in the carrying of the mountains into the midst of the sea. Brown Driver Briggs says when, and I think that's possibly a good translation for us. At least it conveys the correct idea here. Therefore, will we not fear when the earth be removed and when the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea? It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And this will happen. Word for word, this will be accomplished. What are the mountains which will be carried into the midst of the sea? What are the mountains which will be cast into the sea? And again, I'm sure you know the answer. Revelation 17 verse 9 tells us about how Rome, as a millstone, will be cast into the sea. Literally, Rome, the seat of the papacy, will be submerged literally into the Mediterranean, and it will be no more. Bye-bye Vatican, and all the hideous iniquity which it has been a shelter of. It's the seven hills which those mountains are referring to. In verse 3, when the waters thereof roar and be troubled and the mountains shake with a swelling thereof, I think that tells us that there will be a literal fulfillment to the sea and the waves roaring. Perhaps there will be tsunamis and that sort of thing. Certainly you can look at 48 verse 7 and beyond question we were told in Brother Arthur's address about the east wind taking away the ships of Tarshish or Britain with an east wind, so that there will most certainly be at least some degree of tsunamis. And if there are convulsions, if there are earthquakes, then tsunamis are, unfortunately for the wicked, an inevitable consequence and accompaniment. The earthquakes are referred to in Ezekiel 38 verse 20, and there will be a convulsion of both the literal and political state of things. Not just the earth, but the political earth will have a great upheaval. Isaiah 34 verse 4 refers to that. All the host of heaven shall be dissolved, the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down as the leaf falleth off from the vine, and as a falling fig from the fig tree. Symbolic language, but very graphic, and an excellent depiction of the utter transformation of affairs. A rolling away of the heavens as a scroll. Complete end, a termination to the current state of things in society. And one of the interesting verses in this chapter is verse 9. But if you look at the context, verse 6 is almost identical to Psalm 2. The heathen raged, the kingdoms removed, yet at his voice the earth melted. Verse 8, come behold the works of Yahweh, what desolations he hath made in the earth. And then, he maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. He maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. And we might think it's strange, kind of like on the same lines as what Brother Phil was saying yesterday. We've got talk about peace and goodwill on the one hand, and talk about judgment on the one hand, and you have to try to balance the two together, because you know God has been patient with mankind, really, given the enormity of their iniquities throughout the ages. But when his judgment comes, they will be with great vengeance. And yet it is war itself that will end war. It's war itself which will cause wars to cease unto the end of the earth. Mankind has had the opportunity to seek peace and pursue it. They've had the opportunity to hear that gospel message and they've refused it. Their sound has gone out into the whole earth and their words into the end of the world. At least that was referring to the work of the apostles in the first generation. But throughout the earth, opportunity has gone out for men to change their ways and to do what's right. But instead, as a matter of choice and willful bent, mankind would rather follow iniquity. And what that means is that eventually they'll have to take the rewards for their actions. Those that sow into the flesh, shall of the flesh reap corruption, and judgment will come. But on the other hand, what we would like to think about is, by contrast, the blessings that are still available for us to grasp and take hold of while the opportunity is still around. And one of the most beautiful verses, I believe, in this psalm is in verse 5. Speaking about Jerusalem, when the temple is erect and complete, Elohim is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. Elohim shall help her. Have a look at the margin. When the morning appeareth. The word bokeh, the word for morning, is in that verse. And it's alternatively translated by Davidson, at the turning, that is, at the approach of the morning. Brother Thomas translates it in Eureka 2, Elohim shall help her at the opening of the dawn. And you can understand why the translators maybe thought that the idea being carried there was the idea of early, that God would help her early. But sadly they missed a vital lesson that was being which was in the mind of the psalmist there. The morning is one of nature's beautiful lessons to us, which Brother Steve talked to us about. We'd like to look at some verses to enliven this idea in our minds. Malachi chapter 2 verse 1 to begin. Put Malachi 2, I think Malachi 4 I was meaning. For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. And the day cometh that cometh shall burn them up, saith Yahweh of armies, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Sun of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings, and he shall go forth and grow up as star, calves of the stall. Son of Righteousness, what a glorious and graphic figure there. And what the rising sun does with the dawn is dispel the darkness. As light comes, darkness goes. A beautiful lesson when we think that light symbolizes goodness, righteousness, and darkness symbolizes evil and wickedness. With the rising of the sun comes the end of the night. And another very beautiful image is in Luke chapter 1. Luke 1 and verse 78. This was Zacharias talking at the birth of John, and he was referring to the fulfillment of the ancient prophecies concerning Christ. And he said, through the tender mercy of God, whereby the sun rising from on high hath visited us, to give light to them that sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace. So, as well as the sun depicting righteousness and goodness, it depicts life, freshness, opportunity. Proverbs chapter 4, verse 18. Says that the path of the just shineth more and more unto the perfect day, confirming again that sun rising, dawn, speaks to us of righteousness, goodness, and also glory and perfection. Psalm 30 and verse 5. For his anger endureth but a moment, in his favour is life. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning. As Brother Steve said in his address, he quoted from Brother Grocott and said, the weeping of the night is essential to the joy of the morning. The things we think about with night are perhaps things like sorrow and fear and insecurity, but with the light of the morning comes blessing, beneficence, light and goodness. And what it brings is an end to all those things which is depicted in the symbol by the darkness. It's an end of sorrow, fear, unhappiness, and so forth. And the last one, which is in some ways perhaps my favourite reference to the sun rising, is Psalm 2 Samuel 23. And I'm going to read the words, the translation of Brother Thomas here, which you will all be familiar with, but we're here not necessarily to say anything new, but just to remind ourselves of the glorious things which relate to the future. And they are as follows. Now these words of David, the last, are an oracle of David, son of Jesse, even an oracle of the mighty man enthroned, concerning an anointed one of the Elohim of Jacob, and the pleasant theme of Israel's songs. Yahweh's Spirit spake by me, and his word was upon my tongue. Elohim of Israel spake to me, and the Rock of Israel discoursed, saying, there shall be a ruler over mankind, ruling in the righteous precepts of Elohim, and as brightness of morning he shall rise, the sun of an unclouded dawn, shining forth after rain upon tender grass out of the earth. Though my house is not so with ale, says David, yet he hath appointed for me the covenant of the Olam, ordered in everything and sure. Truly this is all my salvation and all my delight, though he cause it not to spring forth. The tender grass out of earth makes us think of the judgments of the mowing of the grass referred to in Psalm 72. But what we're thinking about here is a time after judgment, after all the woes and calamities have been poured out to purify the earth of its wickedness. And we're talking about a time when that's all over, when there is that ruler over mankind, a just one, ruling and reigning in the righteous precepts of Elohim, as brightness of morning in an unclouded dawn. And this depicts the fruition of hope, the fulfillment of promise, the carrying out of expectation, David's salvation and delight, all he hoped for. This was the vision which was in his mind and which he was hoping for. Lastly, we'd like to think about the river which was referred to. We also sang in Psalm, in hymn 10. Verse 4 says, there is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of Elohim, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. If we drop the italics there, we get the feeling of it perhaps a little bit better, as though the psalmist is there looking and he says, a river, the streams thereof are making glad the city of Elohim, the holy place of the tabernacles, the Mishkan of the Most High. This is a river which is literal. It's the river which is referred to in Ezekiel 47, well worth looking to, which we won't do now, but well worth a look at, because that refers to the streams which will issue forth from the temple, and the temple is positioned then, as we know, the streams issue from north and south of the temple, and then proceed in an easterly direction and go down the mountain. And these waters, it says, are for the healing of the nations. And the rivers go into the Dead Sea, and they infuse life into the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea at the moment, of course, is literally dead. Nothing grows around it. All you have is just the tourists there bobbing up and down in its waters. But there's no fish or anything in there. It's dead. But this river goes into the Dead Sea and infuses life into it. And it, apart from the obvious beauty and blessing that speaks to us of, it's emblematic of the reversal of the curse which brought death to man, and of the goodness which will be diffused throughout the earth when Abraham's seed rules from Zion. And the streams of this river make glad the city of God, because they're the medium of entry into the temple. If the mortals are going to the temple, they have to go through those streams, either north or south, to enter into the precincts of the temple. And what that tells them is that, like baptism tells us, it's an appointed means of cleansing and forgiveness. I said lastly we wanted to talk about the river. Actually, we'd like to talk lastly about the glory of God in verse 10. Be still and know that I am Elohim. I will be exalted among the heathen. I will be exalted in the earth. And this will be the greatest change in the earth. The greatest change is not the political upheaval. It's not the literal earthquakes which will perhaps take down a lot of the cities of the present. It's not the removal of Rome into a submerged city in the Mediterranean. It will be the exaltation of God's name among the heathen. God will not be blasphemed, he will be praised. He will not only be acknowledged, but he will be accepted as Lord over all. He will not receive the will worship of modern Christendom, but the pure offering of enlightened mankind from one end of the earth to the other. For from the rising of the sun and to the going down of the same, his name will be great among the Gentiles, and in every place incense shall be offered to his name, and a pure offering. All the false teachings of the modern world will then be vanquished and destroyed, and the arbiter of all things, God himself, will put an end to all speculation and controversy. So what about us? Our desire must be to be there. This must be our stimulus, as Brother Steve brought out from his psalm, as the hart panteth after the water brooks, so must our soul pant after Yahweh. Keeping this vision vividly in our minds is what will perhaps make the difference for us when we go out into the world to try to carry out some of those lessons which we've learned from this study weekend. Psalm 84, verse 1 and 2. How amiable are thy tabernacles, O Yahweh of armies! My soul longeth, yea, even fainteth, for the courts of Yahweh. My heart and my flesh crieth out for the living ale. And this is what must be our frame of mind. Our outward display doesn't really matter. That won't be the basis of acceptance. But whether we love his appearing. Of course, if we don't love his appearing, there will be no outward display. But we need to be careful that our outward display is not anything more than an outward display. We must have our hearts conformed to God's precepts. Paul said that crown of righteousness didn't only await him, but them that love his appearing. Those who whose heart and flesh crieth out for the living God, whose soul longs and faints for the courts of Yahweh, who hunger and thirst after righteousness. Hebrews 9 and verse 28, last but one passage. So Christ was once offered to bear the sins of many, and unto him them that look for him shall he appear the second time without sin unto salvation. And our final passage is in Romans 2. Verse 6. Who, that is God, will render to every man according to his deeds. To them who by patient continuance in well-doing seek for glory and honour and immortality, eternal life. And it really is as simple as that. As we said, seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be opened unto you. If we seek for him with our whole heart, he shall be found. And in the words of Psalm 46 verse 1, he will be found exceedingly. And that's what we need to do whilst the time is still called the present.